You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Studio One. This is Emma Nelson. Ahead in the next 30 minutes, IS claims it downed the Russian airliner over Sinai, but Egypt's president dismisses it as propaganda. We'll examine claim and counterclaim with my studio guests, Xenia Wickett and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Also ahead, we'll ask if Russia is softening its stance on Assad, as Moscow says that keeping the Syrian president in power isn't absolutely necessary. And is Libya using the migrant crisis to hold Europe hostage? Plus, Thatcher fails where McQueen and Bowie flourish. The V&A says no to Maggie's wardrobe. That's all to come in the next half hour here on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So a very warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today, Xenia Wickett, US Project Director at Chatham House, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University of London and the author of What If Latin America Ruled the World. Welcome to the programme, both. Mechanics and common sense may suggest otherwise, but Islamic State militants have claimed responsibility for the crash involving a Russian airliner at the end of last week. More than 200 people, most of them tourists, on their way home from Sharm el-Sheikh, died when the Airbus A321 broke up mid-air over Sinai. The Egyptian president has now dismissed IS claim as propaganda. Xenia, is he right?
We don't know. I mean, honestly, we don't know. So there's two answers. We don't. We haven't seen any intelligence. At least we haven't seen anything out of the Americans. We haven't seen anything out of the Egyptians, out of the Europeans, to suggest whether it was or was not IS or some IS affiliated group. And that matters. Clearly, we want to actually get to the bottom of this, not least because if it was some technical issue, then that's pretty important to figure out, as well as the politics of knowing whether it was or wasn't and what they are and are not able to do. But the other part of it is, it's also about perceptions. Whether or not IS did shoot them down or shoot the plane down or not, as long as there are people who believe that, as long as the propaganda, the messaging actually has an impact, and it clearly does, then we actually have to recognize that the truth is while not being irrelevant for the reasons I mentioned earlier, that the truth is only affects some of the dynamics, some of the decisions. So I think it goes without question that actually the propaganda is working to some extent. The truth is important, but is perhaps secondary.
It's been an interesting few days in terms of the way that the narratives have sort of diverged from the Russian and the Egyptian point of view. That we started off a few days ago with both countries saying this is a mechanical fault, all eyes were on Airbus. And then suddenly, as the weekend progressed and claim and counterclaim and evidence emerged, all of it very sketchy, it appears that Russia is blaming terrorism and Egypt is blaming the Russians for having a wonky plane. How important is it? Xenia's just touched on the importance of the propaganda machine working, but how does each claim affect both Russia and Egypt?
Well, it is very important, absolutely. In terms of Russia's perception, we all know that the specter of what happened in Afghanistan lingers in the memory of Russian citizens. So if that is the case, then to have so early into the game, a demonstration of the unbearable and terrible side effects of the intervention would have an impact on Russian citizens' approval or not. For now, the approvals in Russia are quite high. They seem to be on the side of their government. But there is absolute clarity that this is an issue. Now, on the Egyptian side, given I just came from the country, in fact, 3 weeks ago, and you can see how important it is for the government to maintain what ever lingering trust particularly in the tourist industry there is. And you can see when you're there that most tourists are now coming from either Russia or the East. So these would affect them at the same time. I think that it is too early to say what happened. We have the airlines director blaming an external influence for the crash, whatever that might mean. And of course, one can construe that in many ways. The Federal Aviation Agency director, Alexander Neradko, saying this is all nonsense. We don't have enough intelligence. But even if this is not a case of ISIS involvement, we have been warned that we should expect something like this happening.
Because, of course, there are two things at play here that Egypt must not lose. First is the war over losing tourist numbers, what Oscar has just described. If the airspace over Sinai is threatened in terms of security, and we've already seen Lufthansa and Air France have stopped flying over Sinai. British Airways have been flying around it for some time anyway. Mm-hmm. That is a huge problem for them in terms of tourist numbers. Secondly, to have any suggestion that the situation is not fully under Sisi's iron-like control in Sinai, that is another huge problem for him.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is why I kind of say that there's a truth element to it that clearly matters. And as both you and Oscar have laid out, you know, from the Egyptian side, the economics is everything. And if the tourists suddenly stop going, if people stop flying, that will have huge implications, because unless Sisi can actually show his people that he can provide security and he can provide economic development, he's in a lot of trouble. And both of those
is
things
he?
Are... He has the potential to be in a lot of trouble, because, I mean, you know, what is it that we ask of a government? We ask of a government that they keep us secure, that they provide us with prosperity to be able to feed ourselves and our families. And if you can't do those things, then you lose vast amounts of legitimacy. That's a real problem. For all of the critique about Mubarak, he did provide security and he did provide, you know, a certain amount of economic development. So that is a significant problem. The other part of this that's really interesting to me, going back to the propaganda idea, is what we've seen from both the Russian and the Egyptian, from the kind of administrative side, from the governmental side, is a lot of uncertainty. It's this, no, it's this, no, they don't know what they're talking about, it's this. You know, on the one hand, that's realistic. You know, we're trying to find things out, and they're being transparent and they're being upfront. You know, and one of the things that we have learnt along the way is that if you're not transparent and you don't get information out there early, then people will make it up. On the other hand, it is precisely that transparency and that uncertainty that is leading people to say, well, actually, maybe there are lies going on, maybe that people aren't being entirely truthful, as opposed to IS that is coming out with one line, it's sticking to that one line, and as such is actually gaining credibility because of it. It's a real dilemma that governments have.
It is it's exciting to watch in terms of the way that these arguments in public are being held. But what I wonder, Oscar, if it were true that IS were somehow responsible for an explosion occurring mid-air that led to the destruction of this aircraft, Russia's involvement in Syria in the last few weeks has been clear. They have said they've been targeting IS militants. We'll come to who they've really been targeting a little later on. But the fact is that they have been publicly taking a stance against Islamic State. And a lot of people, as soon as this happened, warned something's going to happen to something Russian and it's going to cause huge problems. Could this be it?
It could. Let us remind ourselves that a similar story took place when seemingly a Russian missile down a European plane over the Ukraine and or that airspace. And then the next question was, well, who provided that missile? And then fingers were pointed at Russia. Well, now we could have a similar story, but in reverse. Who provided those missiles to IS? Where did they get those? Where are they getting their funds and so on? That could be problematic, particularly if, as it seems, and we're going to talk about that later on, there are some signals that a diplomatic arrangement might be possible. Because that was, as far as I'm concerned, that was the aim from the very beginning, to have you know, those the key players at the table: Turkey, Iran, Russia, the Western allies, and so on and so forth. And if that is the case, then these sorts of questions might be hugely problematic. And in addition to that, as I already pointed out, the trust issue in Russia is key. There is clear nervousness about a repetition of what happened in Afghanistan.
Oscar's talking obviously about the involvement of Russia in Syria and these talks in the last few days. How much do you think that the downing of this aircraft are going to feature in the way that Russia is now perceived within the Middle East in terms of the Syria situation? It's not a direct factor, but it's certainly to be discussed.
I think it's less how Russia is perceived within the Middle East. I mean, you know, I'm sure we will talk about the talks that are taking place and the actors sitting around the table and the progress or lack thereof. But, you know, if you go back, you know, back to what Oscar was saying, if you go back 2 or 3 weeks when the Russians, or back to September, I guess it's a bit longer than that, when the Russians first got involved in Syria, and, you know, the West's response was very much a, do they really know what they're doing? You know, this will only come back to bite them. And, you know, as you know, I spend most of my time following the United States. And there's been a huge critique over President Obama's, what is perceived as being President Obama's or America's lack of action and activity in Syria. And I think that a lot of that has stemmed from the sense that, yes, this is awful what's going on, but we shouldn't act just for the sake of acting. We actually need to be able to do something before we actually put resources to it. What Russia has done, and this is, you know, what you heard in the American press, is Russia, for all sorts of reasons, not least of which was probably to turn attention away from Ukraine, Russia's acted for the sake of acting. Russia's acted for domestic reasons because they wanted to turn attention away from Ukraine. And what we are likely to see, unless Russia can find some good way to extricate itself, it is unclear whether, you know, whether or not this was IS who brought down the plane. It is pretty likely that there will be something similar where IS will go against Russian interests as long as Russia continues to act in Syria.
So a question to both of you. If you were in Moscow, if you were in Cairo, what line would you be spinning at the moment? You said there's been a great divergence, that you know, the rows have been played out in public. How would you rein this in?
Oscar.
As I suggested already, I would put all my bets behind the possibility of a political solution with the other allies, which would leave us, you know, if we were Russia, actually in a really nice position of openness and so on and so forth.
I was talking about the plane. Thank you very much for solving the Syria crisis as well.
And Syria, I agree. On the plane, I mean, I think that what you need to do, and I'm trying to remember, you know, when the plane went down in, was it, this is shocking that I don't remember anymore, was it Malaysia? And there was, this is a year or so ago, we never found the plane. And there was, you know, the problem, lesson learned, was you can't get out there and say something and then say something else and then say something else. You also can't say nothing. So what is actually needed if I'm sitting in Moscow is I figure out who is the person who's going to release information. There is one person. Everything is channeled through that person. That person keeps talking to the media, even if it's saying the same thing.
Well, let's stay in that kind of part of the world. We have been discussing Syria ever so slightly. Let's develop that, indeed, the way Russia's influence is playing out in that neck of the woods. Moscow, of course, has been a key supporter of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. Russia's sent equipment and, it's been suggested, troops to help Assad's regime battle the rebels. And, of course, those Russian airstrikes intended to take out IS targets, instead directed towards opponents of the regime instead. So why, Oscar, has Moscow claimed today that Bashar al-Assad need not be a crucial part of Syria's future?
Well, this is not necessarily a huge U-turn. You know, we have at least precedents, two precursors for that. You remember that story according to which, you know, the story came from a Finnish diplomat, according to whom there had been already a suggestion that Russia was not wedded to al-Assad indefinitely, and that as part of a greater scheme for solving the civil war, he could go at a certain time. And the second one is the fact that, as has been clarified, What seems to be the kernel of Russia's position is, and others, in fact, is a position against regime change. And actually, again, going back to spinning, this would be the best way to put it, for all sorts of reasons. Because I think there is growing consensus that regime change, whether that was the actual and only objective of the kinds of interventions that we have seen in the last decade and a half, whatever your position is on that, it seems to be that regime change has failed, terribly so in the area. If that is the case, and if there is there are concerns concerning, in relation to the legality of that, which remain, even the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Commons seems to agree on that, then actually, to press the point of rather than regime change, let's go for an all-party solution makes sense.
Zainab, we've seen this happen in Ukraine, one could argue, that the deed versus word game, that they say they're not doing anything, but in fact they are. When asked, I think it was the Russian spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, said that, if saving the Syrian leader was absolutely it for Russia. This spokesman said, absolutely not, we never said that. You mentioned a moment ago the idea of Russia acting for the sake of acting. Is this where truth and where word and deed actually part company?
I think this is diplomacy. I mean, this is, if you want to come up with a solution, you don't go into the negotiations with very strong public positions unless you actually don't want to come up with a compromise solution, in which case you do. You anchor very, very hard and everybody has to come to you because actually you don't care about the rest. Russia's put itself in a position right now where it needs, unless it wants to continue acting in Syria over the long term, it needs to come up with some kind of progress, whatever that might be. The most likely progress is, or the most necessary progress, is really political progress. So Russia has provided a little wiggle room. As Oscar says, this is, and I think this is to some extent true, and you've actually seen this on the American side as well. The rhetoric is, it's all about Assad. It isn't, actually. It's all about a legitimate government that represents the people of Syria. It right now, or originally, we were all laying that out in the personification of Assad. And what everybody's doing now is stepping a little bit away from that link so that there is a little bit more wiggle room for everybody around the table. What is more interesting, I just want to put on the table, is actually, I think, less about where Russia and the US are, but actually where Iran and Saudi Arabia are, who are the other two actors at the table.
Or perhaps indeed Russia and Iran. It's been suggested that by not giving unequivocal support for Assad, Russia is publicly distancing itself from Tehran, which of course so heartily supports Bashar al-Assad.
Again, watch this space.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with Emma Nelson, Zainab Wicket and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Coming up after the break, we examine Libya's threats to flood Europe with migrants and we'll ask why Margaret Thatcher's outfits didn't pass muster with the VNA. Stay with us.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. The time is 18:18 here in London. This is Emma Nelson. Joining me in the studio, Zainab Wicket, who's a US Project Director at Chatham House, and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University in London. Now let's move on to Libya, a country that has said it will flood Europe with migrants if the EU doesn't recognise its new government. Libya's General Congress took control of Tripoli last year. It seized power from the House of Representatives government, and that's an authority that's internationally recognised. Well, it has echoes of a threat from the colonel himself. 10 years ago, Gaddafi threatened to turn Europe black if Europe did not pay him £4.1 billion in aid every single year. Oscar, this is quite something from a country which was arguably liberated from the regime of Gaddafi and then goes and bites the hand, one is saying. Or is this actually just you shouldn't try and back a horse that you're not sure is going to win?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of George Orwell and the abuse of political language. We should really rescue the term liberation, you know, because this is you know, we're talking about the failure of regime change. Well, this is what happens. You produce a vacuum of power, and of course, something has to fill that vacuum. And most times, or at least in this case, certainly, you don't necessarily know who's filling that vacuum. The result is the return of the repressed. And what has been repressed, and you already suggested that, is this idea that Libya would become, you know, the gate through which migration would enter. I hate the metaphor flow and swarms and so on and so forth, but it is the case. Yes, Gaddafi had said that at that point. He said so again during the bombing campaign in Tripoli. He said, so, okay, if you get rid of me, you're going to have this problem. And, lo and behold, that is exactly the case. Now we have these two declared governments, one which is recognized by the inverted commas international community, another one which isn't but dominates on the ground. And again, they're issuing this threat. What is incredibly tragic and horrible is how people, suffering people, are being turned into weapons once again.
Zinia, it's not as if there haven't been some rather strenuous efforts to try to bring Libya together. I think it's only a couple of weeks ago since both factions involved, both these self-declared governments, rejected the terms of a United Nations brokered peace deal. Who are we blaming here? Are we blaming here? I mean, do we point the finger at Europe saying, okay, you know, they got involved and now they have to reap what they sowed? Or is this just something, or is this just Libya just being Libya difficult?
So, I mean, I think there's two points that we should take away from the story. The first is that much in the case of Syria, it is one thing to go in and remove somebody, but actually rebuilding a legitimate, and I underline the word legitimate, government is not something you can do externally. It's got to be driven internally. The parties have got to want to come together. The problem, one of the many problems that we have in Libya today, is the parties don't want to come together. They're still jockeying for position, as in fact they are doing in Syria. They're jockeying for position. They all want to get on top, and they haven't yet realized that kind of prisoner's dilemma-esque fashion, that actually if they work together, they could probably certainly create a greater good, but might actually create a greater position for themselves.
That's the problem with democracy.
There's the other part of it, which is you have floods of refugees coming from the Middle East and from parts of Africa trying to find a better life for themselves because the one that they have provides them with nothing. That is a fundamental problem. You can take Libya out of the equation, but whatever it is, that's a fundamental problem that we are all going to have to face. And it isn't sufficient for Europe or the Americans, for that matter, or many of the Asian countries, because, of course, there's huge migrant and refugee crisis in Asia as well. It isn't enough just to say that's somebody else's problem. We're going to shut our doors. This is going to be happening, whether it's happening through Libya or it's happening through somebody somewhere else. Yes, we're fixated right now on the fact that there is a rogue, if you want to call it, government in Tripoli that is threatening to use that as a tool. And I agree with Oscar, that's a shocking thing. But it is equally shocking to realize that there are people whose lives are so destitute that this is what they choose to do, and we're ignoring it.
There is that issue as well, Oscar, isn't there, that not only is there the political gamble that this government is taking, but actually, Libya can't afford to look after these refugees. There are millions being spent to fund detention centres, repatriation programmes, trying to stop the refugees from getting over the Mediterranean. Libya has, to a certain degree, got a point insofar as, OK, don't play the political card, but do ask for help because it can't cope with what it's got to deal with.
Look, this issue has been there for a very long time. Spain has been negotiating with Morocco and others for a very long time for very similar reasons. We have a vicious circle of war in Syria, expelling people to other places, and particularly to Europe through Yemen. And then they arrive in Greece, which also doesn't have enough monitoring infrastructure to take care of them. In spite of that, we here in Europe keep acting as if that was somebody else's problem. It is. I don't care anymore if this is a problem of our own making or whatever. It is a problem. It is our problem, and it will continue to be our problem for a very long time. Not one that we can solve on our own if we do not collaborate with North Africa and others.
What therefore, Oscar, do you suggest should be done in terms of the immediate Libyan situation? Does Europe have to be a little bit more flexible and accept an organisation, a government, which it does not wish to accept?
It will have to talk to probably all parties in order to set up deals. I mean, I'm not certain that the kinds of deals that Spain has with Morocco would pass the moral test, but at least for the sake of argument, of the realist argument, that needs to happen. And it also, what also needs to happen is that we here in Europe must accept that this is something that will change forever the face of Europe. These realities there already, whether the National Front of France and UKIP like it or not.
Do you agree?
Absolutely. We're trying to pretend this isn't happening to us. But, you know, as Oscar says, this is happening. This has been happening for a very long time. We need to stop denying it or saying this is somebody else's problem and closing our eyes to it. And as I say, I mean, this is happening very much in Asia, and you're seeing a lot of blowback in Asia over refugee crisis and the movements there as well. We need to find a better way of dealing with the actual problem as well as dealing with the repercussions, the kind of knock-on effects.
Finally, let's shift gear quite dramatically. McQueen made it, Bowie made it, Maggie has failed to secure a spot in the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London. The institution known for cutting-edge design has turned down an offer from the family of Britain's former Prime Minister to exhibit some of her clothes and accessories. Instead, the handbags and putty bow blouses will be sent for auction. We're all queuing up now. Oscar, what's your reaction to this? She is a woman of tremendous, unique and instantly recognisable style. What were the V&A thinking?
Well, me personally, I think her style is terrible. I always thought that that 1975, you know, all European flags dress with which she appeared at a pro market rally should be banned forever. But that's just me.
And it wouldn't suit you. One must concede.
It wouldn't suit anybody.
However, the point perhaps here is that it was her and was unmistakably her.
That might have, that may be the case, but that's not the criterion that the V&A uses. The V&A uses precisely the criterion of high aesthetics, style, and the quality of the craft. And you can see that in David Bowie's attire, you cannot see that in Margaret Thatcher's. But mind you, let's also be honest about it. You know what I can see here is a very diplomatic move from a very well known institution to keep itself out of
The V&A has said that it's not snubbing, but suggesting that her clothes weren't up to scratch in terms of design because they focus on their intrinsic social historical value. I wonder, Xenia, with the queues and the sellout shows of Bowie and McQueen, whether Thatcher would actually pull the same number of crowds, and it's probably perhaps a discreet decision by the V&A not to sell something that might not get all the people through the doors.
I doubt it's actually that. I mean, I think it does come, the V&A tends to focus on acquiring examples of outstanding aesthetic or technical quality. As you put it, she represents, I mean, clearly Thatcher clearly Thatcher, but this was not something that was outstanding or different from the era. She represented a style in the era. She didn't represent something that was fundamentally different from the era. So I kind of get where the V&A is coming from. There is an argument to be made that is, it is still extraordinarily valuable to keep those in a museum that is representing something different, that is wanting to represent a part of Britain's social history, a part of that era. That you can make an argument they should represent it, but maybe not the V&A.
The distinction can be made that whereas, Bowie's attire created a trend and a huge following, not the same can be said about
Thatcher. We'll have to leave it there. Will you be buying the Pussy Blouse, Oscar? No.
I'd rather follow.
I'm after her aqua scutum coat. Zania Wickett and Oscar Guardiola, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. My thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie. For the next half hour, Carlotta Morabella will keep you company with Monocle's international playlist. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.